senior judge and then a state senate show party of interest, case number 50889. First of all, I'd like to advise counsel, after conferring with the justices in Carson City, that we will expand the argument to 30 minutes to each side. The reason for that is we anticipate that justices will have a number of questions, so we want to give the justices a full opportunity to ask their questions, yet give counsel sufficient time to present their arguments on behalf of their respective clients. Also, I believe this is somewhat historical appearance today. It's the first time we've ever had oral arguments en banc in a case where we've had the split, where we have four of the justices in Las Vegas and three in Carson City. So the court and all seven justices met this morning. We felt that due to the issues raised here, we wanted to have an emergency hearing, and we were able to put this together through our video conference equipment. Okay, I can tell that the people watching the proceedings in Las Vegas, our camera is focusing on the bench in Las Vegas, and we can see the podium where counsel will appear. So I cannot see the audience in Las Vegas, so I'm not sure who's there. But what I'll do is we'll go ahead and start with the petitioner here. I believe Mr. Campbell and Mr. Williams represent NBC Universal. So on behalf of the petitioner, they may go ahead and proceed with their opening argument.
May it please this honorable court, Mr. Chief Justice, distinguished members of the court. My name is Donald Jude Campbell. I am of the firm of Campbell and Williams. Mr. Colby Williams is with me and is co-counsel in this case, representing the petitioner in this matter, NBC Universal. Today, this court is going to decide whether federal case law, which has established the provisions of Title 47 U.S.C., 315, have been preempted and have preempted state law. The court will decide whether or not to permit a private cause of action, which we believe has clearly been prohibited. The Supremacy Clause of the United States Constitution, Article 4, provides that Congress has the power and accordingly has allowed it to legislate comprehensively and to occupy the entire field, leaving no room for the states in this particular area. Congress has chosen to do so. It has chosen to do so in a comprehensive manner in an area of political broadcasting, where it is politically particularly sensitive because it implicates the independence of the news media under the First Amendment. Congress has provided for administrative review and decision-making subject to that review and enforcement by the federal courts. In this particular action, the district court decided that it was going to declare that the activities of NBC were in some fashion a breach of contract based upon an invitation that had been sent out and based upon the application of Title 47 of the United States Code, Section 315. We point out, as we have with the citation of the Palmer case and the Forbes case, that in this particular area, Congress has indeed decided to legislate comprehensively. It has preempted in this particular field. It has specifically ruled in those particular cases that there is absolutely no private cause of action. What Mr. Kucinich is doing here today is not unique. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court had an identical case, identical to that which is presented to this court today. There, a candidate decided that he was going to try to go into state district court and get the state district court to declare the process as being unfair. The state district court, and as affirmed by the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, declared that they had no jurisdiction to do that.
Mr. Campbell, did they attempt to, such as in our case, wrap around the contract issue to bring it under state action?
They did not have a contract issue to speak of, Your Honor. But the simple fact of the matter is that in this particular case, this is a disguised contract issue because the principles of the contract which they are enunciating were somehow violated,
clearly implicate the rights, entitlements, and the rulings of the federal courts and Congress's legislation in Title 47, 315. So simply because he has wrapped that in a contract claim does not somehow transform it into something different than what it truly is. It is still the application of federal law. It is still the creation of a private cause of action which has specifically been ruled upon by the federal courts and been declared to be improper. So the simple fact that they didn't go that extra step and try to say we have this private cause of action is really of no import to the court's decision in the Sager case.
Mr. Campbell, are you suggesting then that no contract exists?
We are, in fact, suggesting that no contract exists. And we are suggesting this, that to suggest, as the court did, that there was some showing that there would, in fact, be prevailing on the merits of that particular contract case is, in our view, certainly curious at best. If you look at what was pled, it did not, although it styled it as a contract action, it did not plead any elements of contract, not a single one. What it attempted to do was simply bootstrap. We cited that fact to the court as well. And we point out something else, that with respect to the application of the First Amendment, and what they're saying is essentially that we waived somehow the application of Title 47, 315, because we had this contract, which we did not. But even if that were true, federal law clearly holds that when you're involved in a case in which it's claimed that someone has gone ahead and they have waived their right to assert the First Amendment by basis of a contract action, it has to be clear and unequivocal. We cite in that regard the United States Supreme Court's decision in Curtis Publishing versus Butts in the Associated Press, and that's found at 388 U.S. 130. And Justice Seda, it states specifically in that regard at page 145, where the ultimate effect of sustaining a claim of waiver might be an imposition on that valued freedom, i.e., the First Amendment. We are unwilling to find waiver in circumstances which fall short of being clear and compelling. Here, there is no such contract, but even if there were, there would be absolutely no demonstration, we believe, on the record below that they would go ahead and sustain their burden, let alone that heavy burden with respect to application of the First Amendment to the news media. So we truly believe. Yes, Mr. Justice.
In the same case, the former case seemed to include private causes of action to enforce the fairness doctrine and the equal claim doctrine under Section 315. Is there a case that you've identified that specifically holds that the fairness doctrine, the federal FCC law preempts a private right of action for breach of contract?
With respect to, no. We have not cited one that says it prohibits a private cause of action with respect to breach of contract. What we have cited, though, is the all-inclusive action that it doesn't say one has to tort or contract or any other claim. It says private causes of action. And whether they are disguised as contract or tort or any other basis, they are prohibited irrespective of what that styling might be or what the clever scrivener might try to do with respect to that. If it's based upon this field of law, which Congress has clearly preempted and has initiated a comprehensive scheme of legislation dealing with delicate First Amendment issues, no private cause of action is allowed to in any way disrupt it, no matter how cleverly pleaded.
Could you clarify another issue? The pleadings filed in this case indicate that the district court entered a temporary restraining order. Your pleadings talk about the preliminary injunction. The standard of review by this court would be different. Can you clarify what occurred in the court below and whether the order at issue is a temporary restraining order or a preliminary injunction?
Well, I think it certainly has elements of both, Your Honor. What the order does on page 2 is it states that first it affirmatively imposes upon NBC the right of Mr. Kucinich, the claimed right of Mr. Kucinich, to participate in the nationally televised debate of the Democratic Party. And then it goes on to say that should we decide to not include Dennis Kucinich from full participation in the debate, this court orders that the defendant herein is enjoined from broadcasting the debate. Now, one thing that I think is important to note in this regard and overall in our argument, we are dealing here not with a broadcast station, and 315, with respect to the application of those principles, applies to a broadcast station. And accordingly, we have addressed those because the court has asked us to address them. But we have cited case law and legislative and regulatory decisions which have clearly stated that this does not apply to MSNBC because they are not a broadcast station. They are cable. This is a pay service, private actor. This is not a broadcast station. So even assuming that 315 applied, we win. But we're saying it does not apply in that setting. And we are free, irrespective of what they claim with respect to the application of 315, we are free to decide who will and who will not be included with respect to that debate. And this is... Yes?
So why doesn't that reduce this case to a state law reaching between two private parties?
Because the state law contract action is really a disguised action premised upon and dependent upon the application of 315. They have stated that what we did in that regard was we violated 315 by changing the rules somehow with respect to how we were applying the criteria. And that's simply not the case. And we're saying that those rules don't apply to us, but even if they did, we did not do that. But it's still a private cause of action that's being brought to enjoin the news media. And this is a private actor. Simply because you claim a breach of contract does not somehow dissipate the application or somehow alleviate the constraints of the First Amendment upon the judiciary to act with restraint in this particular area. The First Amendment rights of MSNBC are sacrosanct. And the United States Supreme Court has found that time after time. Two cases we'd like to cite to you in that regard. The first being the Miami Herald Tamayo case. There, a candidate claimed that he had a right of reply, a clear right of reply. The Supreme Court said that they were not going to enforce such a right of reply, even if that right to reply did in some fashion come from the application of state law, which had been adopted by the legislature and signed into law by the governor. They said that what that truly...
The Miami Herald case and the CBS case are compelled speech cases. How does that apply here?
Well, you're compelling MSNBC to present particular speech by Mr. Dennis Kucinich. It's obligating him to not only present that speech, but to also present it at a particular time and place and forum. They are a private actor. MSNBC is a private actor. It is not the state. To suggest that somehow a private actor is subject to the same application of the First Amendment is simply not in conformance and in compliance with the application of constitutional law.
MSNBC gets to decide who will and will not be included in this particular debate. And because this matter has reached this particular forum in the manner in which it has, NBC would like to point out that this is a decision that it made conscientiously and was content neutral. It was not based upon what Mr. Kucinich does or does not stand for. It was based upon the likelihood of his campaign continuing on in some sort of a fashion that gives him any likelihood or chance of success. It's been determined that NBC will now deal with the three front runners in the Democratic campaign. And it has made that decision on a neutral basis, not based upon anything that Mr. Kucinich is likely to say or not say in that regard.
Mr. Campbell, does your reasoning change at all if, in fact, the NBC affiliate in Northern Nevada, Reno, Carson City area shows the debate tonight?
The local station up there? Is that the question?
I believe they're going to show it. Yes, just sort of he's nodding his head. I heard that on the news this morning that they're going to show it on it's Channel 4 up here as the NBC affiliate in Carson, Reno.
MSNBC, in discussions with me, Your Honor, has stated that it is their intention to show this only on MSNBC, particularly if that would have any bearing on the application of the court's decision here today. We are going forward based solely that this is cable or a paid service showing, not on broadcast. So we're going to eliminate any application of that particular statutory scheme in that regard. So the answer is no. And I have had that discussion with NBC as late as this morning with NBC's headquarters in New York. I would like to reserve 10 minutes. I don't know how far I've gone along here.
Yeah, Mr. Campbell, you have, according to our timer here, and I think we said we try to answer parallel timers, I show 15 and a half minutes right now that you have left.
Okay.
Mr. Campbell, very briefly, though, in Mr. McGahee's response to your petition on behalf of Mr. Kucinich, he indicates that you don't meet the standings to be before this court because your client's not showing any irreparable harm. What's your response?
Well, anytime you implicate the application of the First Amendment by the news media, anytime you compel the news media to do something of the nature that the lower court is compelling here, and further prescribes that the failure to do so will result in a compulsion by the state for the news media not to present a political debate, certainly implicates one of the most important and cherished freedoms that we have.
Well, it occurs to me that the part of the relief granted was that the defendant not include defendant not include plaintiff Dennis Kucinich from full participation in the debate. The court hereby orders that the defendant herein is enjoined from broadcasting the debate. I'm not so sure that the issue here is irreparable harm.
We believe it is.
I'm saying that it's clear that that would be caused by enforcing this order.
We believe so. We are suggesting here that there would be irreparable harm, but it would be to MSNBC because it would be abridging our First Amendment rights. You'll see that in the moving papers, there was never a claim asserted by Mr. Kucinich that his First Amendment rights were being abridged. But in fact, if this order is enforced, First Amendment rights will be abridged, but they will be our First Amendment rights. The government will be telling us what and how to do it, and what are the consequences if we don't, specifically prior restraint. And that's exactly what has taken place in this particular order. This order says that if we don't do a particular thing, include Mr. Kucinich, that we don't get to broadcast. It's clear and it's unequivocal, and just as clear and unequivocal as it is also unconstitutional. May I reserve the remainder of my time?
You can. Mr. Campbell's got 13 minutes left. Do any of the other justices have any questions for Mr. Campbell at this time?
Just one other, Mr. Campbell. In your moving papers, you mentioned that NBC attempted to present live testimony, I believe, for Mr. Todd in the first hearing, and that was rejected by the district court judge. Was there any evidence at all by affidavit or otherwise that NBC was able to present that would refute the contract claims?
No, Your Honor, we were not in that position. I think we have included the affidavit here today with respect to our representative.
But the district court didn't have the benefit of that affidavit, is that what you're
saying? No, Your Honor, because we didn't have the benefit of it. To give you some idea of what transpired here, at 11:59, that motion was filed in the court, in the lower court, 11:59. We then scampered to get a hold of NBC in New York to confer with our counsel and try to find someone that could assist us here on the ground in Las Vegas, Nevada, because we had received shortly after the motion an instruction via the court in a telephone call from staff saying that we were to be before Judge Thompson in Department Number 23 at 1:30. So we had a 90-minute window to do whatever we had to do. And we had no time to put together any sorts of affidavit. Indeed, we had to actually hunt down the individual who's presented his affidavit here in today as our Exhibit 1. That's Mr. Chuck Todd. Mr. Chuck Todd is the political news director, and we found him here in Las Vegas, Nevada, sent a car to pick him up, and brought him to the courthouse. He was brought to the courthouse. We then immediately had our hearing, so there was no time for any sort of presentation of affidavits. We asked for the opportunity to present a factual record because we believed setting the foundation with respect to what actually happened would be beneficial to the lower court as well as to this court in the event of an adverse ruling. We were denied that opportunity. We were denied that opportunity because the senior judge involved was required to leave on very short notice to go down to handle drug court. He simply didn't have the time within his schedule. And that's another thing that we think is very, very important here. Mr. Kucinich knows exactly what the procedure is. The law compels him that if he thinks he's been wronged in this regard, that he has to exhaust his administrative remedies. He must go before the Federal Communications Commission.
Well, and isn't that what happened in the ABC case?
I beg your pardon?
The ABC case. So he knows he's...
He knows exactly what he has to do, because he did do it there. And and in Palmer, that's exactly why Palmer denied the applicant's request for relief. They said, you have to go. And there in Palmer, he got word of it on a Saturday, and the debate was on Tuesday. Here he got word Friday morning, and the debate is on Tuesday. So Mr. Kucinich had even more time than the applicant in Palmer had. But for the same reasons that are applicable in Palmer, Mr. Kucinich is out of court. He had to exhaust his regulatory and administrative remedies. He had to file with the FCC first. That's absolutely required. And thereafter, depending upon what their decision, he can go into United States District Court, which has the power to review those decisions. But he cannot simply come into state court and bypass all of that and try to make an end run around with a claim that he has some sort of a contract with us. He still must do that. And his failure to do that absolutely prohibits his prevailing on the cases he's presented. And the case law is absolutely uniform, unequivocal, and without exception in that regard. The FCC has established a regulatory scheme where they deal with such complaints with alacrity. That's what they are there for. Mr. Kucinich knew what the likelihood of his success there was. That's why he didn't choose to exercise that forum. Instead, he tried, like the Palmer applicant, to come in and do something different. And that simply is not allowed.
Okay. Mr. Campbell, you have about 7 minutes and 50 seconds remaining to rebuttal. At this time, Mr. McGay, on behalf of the respondents and Real Party Against Truth, Dennis Kucinich, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. On behalf of Mr. Kucinich, we'd like to thank the court for the opportunity to be here this afternoon. A number of things to address here for the court. I think that one of the overriding considerations in the argument that we just heard is that there's a mixing and matching of some of the concepts here between a contract cause of action and then what may be the remedies with what the federal government has provided in terms of broadcasting. It's very clear in Nevada that there's a long series of case law which talks about promissory estoppel within the contract realm of cases. Starting in 1962, I found that there were at least 11 cases which talk about promissory estoppel and where one person relies upon the representations of another or another entity to their detriment. And I've cited some of those cases to the court. And what promissory estoppel works as, when someone relies upon the representations of another, NBC here, where the reliance is foreseeable, then that serves as a replacement consideration and as a state law claim. And there's any number of situations in this, where this is discussed in the case law with the state. And the policy consideration behind promissory estoppel, and the court cases address this, is that that doctrine is infused to enforce the agreement in order to stop an injustice. And that's the term that's used in the case law. And
well, there's an interesting, that's an interesting point, but the remedy here is goes well beyond, the remedy that the district court provided goes well beyond a remedy that he participated in the debates. It goes on to prohibit the broadcasting of this debate if he's not allowed to participate. I don't know, one, how that fits within a remedy that you might even be entitled to under the doctrine of promissory estoppel. Not only that, but I don't see how, I think that remedy in and of itself creates irreparable harm, not to your client, but to the cable network. So how do you explain that?
No, I think I appreciate what you say, and I think that that's a good argument. And if, for example, if the court were to find that that provision of the order is inappropriate for reasons sufficient under the court, then the court's got the ability and the jurisdiction to change the order and reform it to where the court is comfortable with the application of the order and contract law in this state. If that's an offending provision, but yet you find that there's a valid contract under promissory estoppel, then if that's a problem, that can be taken out of the order revised, and then the contract enforced with NBC, affording him the opportunity to be on the stage, just like they said he could last Wednesday, because the broadcasting provision of it would be taken out and the order reformed that way. So to the extent that contract law in this state indicates that there is an agreement between these parties and the order is to some degree inappropriate in your opinion, then you can reform it and make it appropriate, and then the parties can go forward with the intent that they had on last Wednesday when this was formed. And the cases on this are clear. And in fact, Pink versus Bush, which is the case which is cited at the end of the
brief. This court is not a fact-finding body. This is the Supreme Court. It seems to me that that sort of remedy is probably better placed back in the district court.
Well, and if that were the case, then we could go back down to the 10th floor, Department 10D, and have the order reformed by Judge Thompson. And I'd be very happy to do that, Your Honor, if that's the case. I think we could get that done very quickly. I mean, that is available here before the end of the afternoon. If that really is an issue, it could go back down to the court for that sort of a process to occur.
Did the trial court in this case make any determination or hear any argument on the elements of promissory estoppel? I don't see anything in the papers that have been provided to the Supreme Court that address the four elements of promissory estoppel.
Well, we all hit the ground running on this issue, Your Honor, and when we were before him, and it's addressed somewhat in the complaint and with notice pleading I'm not trying to rely on that as a crutch, but with notice pleading, we indicate that they did form a contract and it was relied upon, and we did argue that to the district court here.
I'm talking about the notice pleading, and I'm talking about what was argued in front of the district court. Did the parties argue that the basis for the plaintiff's claim in this case was reliance or the consideration substitute was promissory estoppel, and argued the elements of promissory estoppel?
We argued our reliance, Judge. I did not use the word promissory estoppel in the hearing yesterday because, frankly, I hadn't had time to hit all the case law on it. I was reading FCC cases beforehand, but I argued the detrimental reliance on that because I know that that's part of the cases. It's been a long time since I researched promissory estoppel, but we argued that, and that's why Judge Thompson said they relied, the Kucinich campaign relied upon these to their detriment, relied upon the invitation, and that they changed their mind and withdrew the invitation afterwards. That was part of his argument. It was even in some of the news programs where they, on video, quoted Judge Thompson, his talking about the campaign relying upon NBC and the invitation. And in fact, NBC in the past has invited the campaign, and he has participated in an NBC debate before. So this is not anything which is new. And we did present that to the court, Judge.
Mr. McGee, are you trying to enforce the provisions of Telecommunications Act by your complaint that seems to be contained in count two? Or are you trying to enforce a simple breach of contract case between two private parties?
No. We pled that obviously because it's in the complaint. But we're trying to first and foremost address clearly the contract here, because that's the simplest remedy here, and it's also the reason why we are here. They met the criteria, the invitation was extended, there was the reliance on the campaign, and those are clear issues. That's why Mr. Kucinich is here in Nevada right now. And so it is a contract.
As you know, the third element of a promissory estoppel requires a showing by your client that the party asserting the estoppel was ignorant of the true state of facts associated with the circumstances under which this debate was going to occur. Is it your contention, and is there any evidence in the record below that Mr. Kucinich was not aware of the criteria and the circumstances under which the debate and its participants would be invited and allowed to participate?
No, you're right, Judge Hardesty, about that third element about the mistake of facts. And in trying to research this before we came down here and trying to find where that interplays with this, I wasn't able to come up with any case which covers this particular situation because it appears to be unique. But the detrimental reliance is there, and the public policy and the case law is there. But in terms of that mistake of fact issue, I'm not so sure that any case in Nevada has directly addressed that. So do I have a case on that? No, I don't, Judge. But the reliance is there, and clearly the detrimental reliance is there. So we suggest that all those cases apply.
Mr. McGahee, if that is true, we come back to a salient issue, and that is this not, if it's a contract action as you're offering, a private right which is preempted by 46 U.S.C.
315? No. Well, I apologize for answering before you're done speaking, but it's not preempted, and I think the part of the confusion, the apples and oranges argument, is NBC is over here broadcasting on stations which are going to be regulated, and then the argument by Mr. Campbell, and I appreciate what he says, is MSNBC is entirely outside of that jurisdiction because it's a private pay-for TV. And all of the cases which they cite here, the two of them that I've seen that were provided to the court below, they don't address that situation, but they want the benefit on both sides.
Well, let's come back, because you're not really answering my question. The question was, this at best is a private right, a private cause of action, private right.
Okay.
And we have a federal law sitting over here on the side. Mr. Campbell indicated that in other jurisdictions, you had to go through and exhaust your administrative remedies first. Why is that not the case here?
We addressed that below with the court. In fact,
why don't you address it here?
Okay. The Campbell case sets out on page 2 of its that was provided to the court, it's the printed page 2, discusses whether or not exhaustion of administrative remedies is an absolute prerequisite, and it is not. Their case law indicates it isn't. In fact, it states that where the exhaustion of administrative remedies would be futile, the courts clearly can still entertain the issue that we're dealing with. And what we're all on the run here. This is happening really quickly because of the timing of this, and we didn't get this until Monday morning, and that's why we're here. And
there's a federal district court, and there's other agencies in this city. We're not in the backwoods. Why couldn't you have gone?
Well, because the district court here under Article 6, Section 6 of the Nevada Constitution gives the district court jurisdiction over a contract claim, and that's why we're here. With that contract, we're here. And therefore, we asked the district court to enforce it, and they did. And that's in the order also. And so the administrative remedies don't have to be exhausted, and their case law indicates that very clearly. And so therefore, we went to the district court here, and that's why they enforced it. The judge below heard the evidence and concluded that there was a contract, and it's within his purview as the district court to be able to do that. He heard the facts. And so that's why we're asking this court to enforce his order and find that the contract is binding. And if there's a problem with it, if we have to reform it to some extent, we could go back downstairs and have the judge reform it based upon this court's directives.
Mr. McGee, in the court below, did the parties argue whether the court had authority to provide an injunctive relief to enforce an oral contract debate?
That specific question wasn't addressed, and I have not found a case whether an oral contract to be at a debate exists anywhere in the case law within the United States, Your Honor. And I was researching that, but I can honestly tell you I don't know the answer to that question if there is a case.
And what was the basis for the district court finding the presence of the contract? You say you didn't argue the promissory estoppel. Apparently, the usual elements of the contract would have been present. What was the basis for the court's finding that there was a contract?
It was the detrimental reliance, and specifically it would be found within the motion that we submitted to the court in Exhibits 3 and 4, which was the criteria for the debate itself, which was set out by the political consultant for NBC, which is Jennifer Baucus, and it's set out in that email, which is sent out to the various campaigns, stating this is the qualification criteria. And then Exhibit number 3, I believe, to that motion was a January 9 email from Jennifer Baucus to the Kucinich campaign, which indicated that based upon that Kucinich qualified and that he was invited, therefore, to the debate tonight. And we submitted to the court additional support in the form of the Gallup poll, which was part of the criteria for NBC, which showed that he finished in an appropriate position in order to be considered as qualified under NBC's criteria for the debate itself. And then we also showed to the court that he's fully qualified for federal matching funds, is a valid candidate for the President of the United States. All of that was presented to the court, along with his meeting the criteria of NBC. The court found that they extended the invitation and that it was accepted by the Kucinich campaign, and that therefore they had that agreement. And that we argued that he detrimentally relied upon that by making changes to be here. In fact, he is here. And that's what was anticipated, that it was foreseeable that he would rely upon their representations to be here tonight for the purposes of the caucus on Saturday here, the 19th, which is the reason for all of this.
You know, you mentioned Jennifer Baucus, and it wasn't clear from what was presented just what her role in this was. Was she affiliated with NBC, or was she affiliated with the coordinating on the Nevada end of this?
There's the affidavit of Steve Cobble, which was submitted with my motion to the court below, which was Exhibit 1, where it's his testimony, sworn testimony to the court below, that Jennifer Baucus was a political consultant for NBC. And there was extensive questioning by Judge Thompson of Mr. Campbell about, you know, does she have the authority to do this? And why would she be inviting them? And, of course, that's the vehicle by which that they invited everybody to the campaign with, or to the debate with, Your Honor. So she is affiliated with and acting on behalf of NBC. And in fact, you see on there on the CC portions of the email itself, and I pointed out this to Judge Thompson, Chuck Todd, who uninvited Mr. Kucinich, was CC'd on all of those emails, and it was CC'd on the email along with other NBC personnel with the decision and the criteria. So she was acting on behalf of NBC. It was very clear, and she was sending out the emails on behalf of NBC, and she was informing everybody there of what was going on. So that, yeah.
I'm sorry, were you finished with your answer?
Yes, sir.
In the papers that we've been provided, I don't find any affidavit from any person in the court below that indicates that Mr. Kucinich was detrimentally relying on the promise. The only affidavit I see is Stephen Collar, where he described the criteria and the process and attaches copies of the email. Did Mr. Kucinich testify, or was there an affidavit or other evidence presented that provides a basis for detrimental reliance?
From a factual point of view, Your Honor, I had to inform the court as an officer of the court of the reliance because we were in the process of trying to get affidavits because of the time that was involved. We didn't have time to do that. And that's what I informed the court of. And that's, as an officer of the court, I talked to the campaign and found out those facts, and I represented those to the court. So that's the basis upon which I informed the court, not in an affidavit. I didn't have time for that, Judge. So, on some of the things that Mr. Campbell addressed, this is a very important public interest, obviously, and that's why we're all here. It is a contract, and this whole issue is wrapped around with several other important public interests. There's the FCC interest, there's a contract interest, there's the interest of the people of the state of Nevada. Article 2, Section 2, which we argued to the judge below, imbues with every citizen, you know, the right to vote. And we moved the caucuses up to the 19th, and that's what has engendered the debate, and that's why Mr. Kucinich was going to be here and is here now. I argued to the judge below that the district court also has jurisdiction relative to that process to enforce the agreement because it does affect the public interest. And indeed, I provided to the court, there is one case, it's in my brief, it's 95 Nevada. It deals with the court issuing an injunction within the realm of the election process. And the court there found that issuing an injunction with something that affects the election process was an appropriate thing to do. And here you've got the same thing occurring, slightly different, but you've got political debates which are meant to affect the way voters act this coming Saturday going to take place. And whether or not somebody's included in that, that directly affects the interests of the people of the state, and whether or not an additional voice is going to be heard. And the contract is a serious point to be taken here. Mr. Campbell wants to belittle it and say that this is really some attempt to regulate NBC on a federal level disguised as a contract claim. No, this is a valid agreement between this monolithic corporation, which is really General Electric, and him, Mr. Kucinich, where he's met their criteria and agreed to be here in this state to debate important public issues tonight. They agreed upon that. And for whatever reason, they changed that criteria, but he relied upon that and is here. And so what we're asking this court to do is to enforce that contract to allow them to put one more of these up on the stage, and he can be asked some questions by Tim Russert. That's it.
Mr. Campbell had made a point, petition, if the shoe were on the foot, let me see what it says here. If the shoe was on the other foot, would MSNBC have a legitimate basis to assert a breach of contract claim against Mr. Kucinich if he chose not to show up?
Well, that's not the issue before the court because he's here.
It's an interesting concept, though.
Sure.
I'm interested in hearing your thoughts.
It's personally, Judge, I think that's a good rhetorical question, but it doesn't address the issue of what we're really dealing with because he is here and he didn't back out on his agreement to be here. Is it reciprocal? Is it reversible?
There may not have been an ability to show irreparable harm from his failure to show up.
There may not, or there may. What they're looking for is ratings.
If it was, aside from all the polemics, the...
Right.
If the shoe was on the other foot and Mr. Kucinich had determined to breach the agreement to appear, it may have been more difficult for NBC to show irreparable harm from his absence.
Right. But I think that whole point goes to the detrimental reliance. Because it may not be so important to NBC, but it is extremely important to him and to the people who would vote for him or the people who would listen to him.
There's no question about that.
Yeah.
But there is also this question, and that is, did Mr. Kucinich have an administrative remedy with the FCC?
A technical one?
Yes.
Well, I think there's always a technical remedy. Is there an adequate remedy?
Did he have the right to redress this grievance with the FCC?
No, not within the time period that we have here, as far as I know.
I'm not talking about legally. Did he have that option?
Does he have the option there?
Yes.
As far as I know...
Does he have an administrative remedy? Forgetting your argument about the timing, does he have an administrative remedy in front of the FCC?
Two parts. Probably sure, because there's always that avenue. Secondly, is it adequate or is it appropriate under these circumstances? No.
You're saying that he has a remedy, but he's established futility.
Futility, correct.
What was his argument? What was the showing in front of the district court about that futility?
Well, we discussed that with the judge, and based upon what we presented to Judge Thompson, that we were there yesterday, the debate is this evening, and the timing of this, there's no time to go anywhere else. This is where the contract is formed. We don't have the ability to be in any other forum but here. And that based upon, we've got a day or less. This is the only forum which can appropriately address this, the contract claim, the law.
Mr. McGee, if I could follow up on Justice Moffitt's question. If the Communications Act of 1934 does not apply to NBC Universal because it's a cable television, then would he have an administrative remedy? Because the administrative remedy would only apply to those that are governed by the Act.
Well, within the petition presented by NBC, I don't see anything which supports that. I personally don't know, Your Honor, because I'm not an expert in that area, and I can't stand here and pretend to tell you that I have a case on that, and I'm not going to. But
Mr. McGee, let me ask you this. This is Justice Gibbons in Carson City. What's your response to Mr. Campbell's argument that assuming there were a remedy available with the FCC, that the proper forum would be to address this in the United States District Court as opposed to the state courts of Nevada?
It still doesn't negate the contract claim. Even if there's some FCC issue there, there's still a contract claim, and it comes down to a basic contract to have him be at a debate. Now, they concurrently would broadcast that, but it's still an agreement to have a man come to a debate, stand on stage, and answer some questions about his political views. That's as simple as it is, but there's also, it's a simple contract, and that's why it's very clear and the remedy is appropriate here.
So you're saying that the contract claim is a standalone proposition, and because it's a contract claim, the issue of administrative remedies is not relevant?
Not to the contract claim, yeah. I mean, it would be a separate argument if you wanted to go to an administrative room and argue this isn't fair and balanced, or you're not giving an appropriate forum here based upon your duties under the FCC or whatever. That's different from the contract claim, which was you asked, I relied upon your agreement with me to be on stage and answer questions. I mean, the debate would still be sponsored. Let's say they decided not to even broadcast it. The debate would still occur. And you could still, the contract could still be enforced, and he would stand up there with, like it was agreed, and answer questions. That's what it comes down to. So it's a matter of being on stage and being in the debate itself, which is the important issue here. And that's the contract claim. That's the contract claim, Judge. So all the other issues about First Amendment and the case law that they presented clearly show that there's a valid exception here on the administrative remedies. And when time is of the essence here, and that's what we're dealing with in the public interest, we're asking this court to allow him to be on stage and to enforce the agreement, which NBC and Mr. Kucinich came to, and for them to do what they agreed to do in the first place. It is an important public interest. And the contract law allows for that. And it would be an injustice under that contract for him not to be on stage tonight and answer questions about his political issues that people at State and Nevada are going to be interested in. And if there are no other questions, that's...
Hey, are there any other questions for Mr. McGee by members of the court?
I guess the thing that troubles me, Mr. McGee, if you could comment on this, a private party invites someone to debate and tells them this is some of the criteria. Can't that party modify the criteria and uninvite the invitees?
Well, based upon the cases, there's detrimental reliance, and that person who was originally invited has a remedy under the law. Of course, you're free to change it, but that doesn't take away from Mr. Kucinich the remedy. You know, he can change the criteria and say, I'm not going to invite you now, but if he's relied upon that and people have changed their positions and an injustice is going to be done, then you can enforce the remedy, which specific performance here would be to be at the debate. So it doesn't, by changing the criteria, it doesn't take away the cause of action. It's still going to be there. The injustice is still going to be foisted upon Mr. Kucinich by changing the criteria, and the remedy will always be there.
What was the reasoning for not allowing Mr. Todd to testify in district court?
Mr. Todd?
Yes. He was president of court, as I understand it.
Judge Thompson asked him questions other than what they wanted Mr. Todd to discuss. He asked him specific questions about authority and indicated that he's got a limited amount of time, and that's true. That's what he stated. And then indicated that he's going to make a ruling based upon the facts that he has. Asked him, what would he say? And then I believe that's what Mr. Campbell addressed. Okay.
Okay, any other questions from the court? Okay, thank you very much, Mr. McGee. Before I hear from Mr. Campbell and rebuttal, Mr. Campbell, I think you have 7 minutes and 10 seconds.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. With all due respect to my learned colleague of the bar, Mr. McGaha, I don't believe that we were in the same hearing yesterday, because not once in any of the arguments or papers presented was there ever a claim that there was detrimental reliance in any form or fashion by Mr. Kucinich. Not once. You can comb the record and you will not come up with anything that even approaches that. Nearly the entire argument was dedicated to the application of federal law, specifically Title 47, Section 315. I don't know where this promissory estoppel argument comes from here today, but I think it comes from the fact that we raised the notion that he has no private cause of action, but even if he did, he didn't plead one. He didn't even cover the elements of the actual claim itself for breach, let alone an exception to the application of those elements. And in that regard, I want to make one...
Mr. Campbell, I can understand why you devote as much time as you have to the question of the Federal Communications Act because of the arguments below. But if, as you maintain, your client is exempt from that act, then isn't this just a breach of contract case as contended by the plaintiff, and the... Federal Communications Act really doesn't play any role in the resolution of this dispute.
And respectfully, no, Justice Hardesty, because the United States Supreme Court has clearly ruled, and the cases that we have cited the court so hold, that Congress has preempted this field. This is a matter with respect to the application of sensitive constitutional principles to the news media, specifically the electronic news media here. If you are going to grapple with those very particularized rules which Congress has adopted and seeks to enforce through the federal courts, you have to follow those rules. And if you believe that there has been some sort of a breach because you have no private cause of action, you must exhaust your administrative remedies. And that is precisely the holding of the case that we cited to the court and we discussed a few moments ago with Justice Saeta. That is Palmer versus Fox Broadcasting.
So what you're arguing is a statute to which your client is exempt preempts a cause of action against your statute, against your claim?
No, Your Honor. What we are saying is that because Congress had seen fit to preempt the field and has assigned the FCC the exclusive administrative duty to regulate the news, electronic news industry with respect to First Amendment matters, that it has to be brought in the first instance there. And that is, and whether you color it as some type of private cause of action, which the courts always say doesn't exist or not, you still have to go there. And that's why the court in Palmer said that. And there, remember, it was on Saturday that they found out, and he came into court right after that saying he didn't have enough time. The court said that does not do away with the requirement, and it cited a Supreme Court case for that, which was Beluso versus Turner, and it said as follows. The commission has published specific procedures for political candidates seeking to enforce Section 315, use of broadcast facilities by candidates for public office. These complaints are given priority consideration by the commission. The Supremacy Clause has controls here. Congress has seen fit to preempt in this delicate area of the application of certain laws and regulations dealing with the First Amendment rights of the media. They control. He cannot come in with a cleverly disguised cause of action saying that it's really breach of contract. Sager says precisely that. The state courts have no jurisdiction. He has to have gone into before the FCC and then into federal court. And I would point out one other thing with respect to that contract.
So if I'm a political candidate and I want access to a cable television network, you're asking me to go through the first instance to the FCC.
Yeah, if he is going to in some fashion prevail, he has to exhaust, we believe, his administrative and remedies that exist under federal law in federal court. But if I might, I'd like to mention something with respect to the issue of promissory estoppel. We didn't choose to bring this. Mr. Kucinich, at least his representatives, were informed, and there's no question about this, Friday morning at 9 o'clock. So I don't know where Mr. Kucinich was all day yesterday, but he certainly wasn't in court trying to support what he believes is his valuable right to participate. He was somewhere else doing something else. We don't know what. But he certainly wasn't there to give any evidence, and he was the one that bore the burden of going forward with the evidence, not us. And we point out once again that this was a hearing in which we did not seek out the court. They sought out the court. We were informed that we were to be there on less than 90 minutes notice and to address some important concerns that the court had in that regard. The first thing we did was we told the court it had no jurisdiction, the very reason that we believe that we are here today. It had no jurisdiction to decide these important issues. But moreover, we also want to emphasize the fact that here today, this court is now presented with an order that doesn't contain a word about detrimental reliance, but it certainly contains some very, very important words about the abridgment of the First Amendment rights of MSNBC. It specifically constitutes a prior restraint. Now, if Mr. Kucinich truly believes that he has suffered some damages from all of this, well, I guess he can sue us some later point in time. But the remedy is not to abridge the First Amendment rights of the news media in this particular matter that's presently before the court.
Okay. Any other questions for Mr. Campbell from members of the court? Okay, if not, thank you very much, Mr. Campbell.